Just got 9 minutes after 8 o'clock. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And welcome to the show, the MJC Speaks, where we give a voice to the advocacy work and the research of the Muslim Judicial Council. Tonight we have a special focus on the Muslim Marriage Bill. We know that's been a hard nut to crack for our activists, our ulama, our legal experts, and just the general public, because the matter is now being played out in the courts. And tonight we want to try and understand what exactly this is all about. So just to give you some context, as we know, the Women's Legal Center has taken national government to court for failing to pass legislation that will give Muslim marriages recognition. It is argued that Muslim marriages, solemnized in terms of Islamic and Muslim rights, has no legal recognition in South Africa. So the question we're asking tonight is, how do our local ulama view this issue? And that is what we are hoping to unpack in the next hour. Of course, we welcome your comments. You can WhatsApp us on 072-238-0712 or SMS 47913. Joining me in the show tonight, I've got Sheikh Ihsan Talib, the president of the United Ulama Council of South Africa, also an MJC Exco member, and Sheikh Munir Abdurrauf, an MJC Exco member as well, an attorney and a lecturer at UWC's law faculty. Lots of hats to wear this evening. Shukran so much for joining me, and assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Yeah, so certainly, like I said in the introduction, Sheikh Ihsan, if you can just move the mic a little bit closer to your mouth so that you can project well. Yeah, definitely, like I said earlier, you know, a very complex issue, and something that's been in the news lately. Well, it's been in the news for a very long time, but it's sort of gained prominence now recently with this court case by the Women's Legal Center. So I know about 2 weeks ago that, you know, the Women's Legal Center, government and interested parties, they appeared before the Western Cape High Court on this particular issue. So I suppose the big question here is, why, if we take a step back, why have women been fighting for this legislation for so long? Maybe, Sheikh, you can start with giving us the context to this case.
Yes. Shukran very, very much, Tasneem. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillah, wassalatu wassalamu ala rasulillah. I think the process obviously has been an ongoing one, as I think we all can kind of bear testimony to and attest. The Women's Legal Center, in this sense, therefore, is carrying on with a process which they themselves have also started a bit of a while back, in terms of separate legal action which they've also taken to the Constitutional Court at the time. This time around, they've obviously, as a result of that process there, they've obviously come to the one of the high courts in our country, and as you've indicated, calling upon government, or rather, petitioning government basically to bring about legislation and a legislative framework. The reason for all of this obviously is that women in our country have been suffering largely as a result of the lack of recognition of Muslim marriages. The issues that have been basically playing itself out on a kind of a day-to-day basis, the Women's Legal Center is one of those agencies where women would go to try and get legal redress and legal recourse. Our informal judiciaries, of course, as we know in our country, like the Muslim Judicial Council, we also render this kind of service to the community and the society. But the big problem obviously arises is that when these disputes are brought in front of the MJC, and whether it's the Jamiat or wherever we go in the country, these disputes are kind of resolved in certain ways, and awards are kind of handed down. And then if any of the parties are just not interested or are not very impressed with the ruling that had been handed down, they can just take their jacket and walk away from the process, and there's nothing nobody can do. So there's obviously no executive authority, there's no legal sort of binding nature on these, and there's no legal enforcement. And this is obviously a critical thing in order to secure justice. In fact, we know that from our heritage and our kind of Islamic tradition, you know, the likes of the second Khalif, Sayyidina Umar radiallahu ta'ala an, when he, in fact, appointed one of his judges by the name of Shuraih al-Qadi, He had in his appointment letter explicitly provided that it really doesn't matter a lot that we speak about the rights of people and that we speak about how the Sharia secures the maslaha of society, and that it in its essence is all about compassion and justice, when that's not able to be secured for people, when they cannot be when they can't have access to those rights. And so that is obviously the essence of what laws are about, that people are able, and rights are about, people are actually able to enjoy them. And so it is for this kind of reason, obviously, that this process has kind of advanced, with the hope and the idea that there would be some kind of recognition of Muslim marriages secured. And the way in which they're going about doing that is obviously by kind of petitioning government to be able to say that, look, you've been negligent to not bring about a legal sort of framework and a legal sort of process of legislation, and that you are by constitution obliged to do so.
Am I correct in saying that UKSA, or rather the MJC, was submitted as a friend of the court and also made submission in that regard?
That is correct, yes. Obviously, we've admitted ourselves and has been accepted as friends of the court. And the importance of all of this is that, you know, we made the point also in our some of our discussions that the whole idea that we are there is to obviously state our case in the context of how the court will be viewing and be sort of evaluating the case in front of it. So we felt that it is important that we also put forth the position of the United Ulama Council, representative of its constituencies, as to what we believe, what our position is in this particular regard.
Sheikh Munir, maybe if I can bring you in here, what exactly are the contents of that submission? What are the UKSA and the MJC saying in support of the MMB?
Yes, it's a very important question. Based on what Sheikh Hassan has basically stated now, from a Muslim point of view, right, we should have enforceability. In terms of South African law, we're looking at from a constitutional dimension, right? You have a right to equality. And the question is that it's been posed in the court during the presentations was that the South African citizens have the right to get married in terms of the Marriage Act, right? Even Muslims, right? The gays and lesbians, they can get married in terms of the Civil Union Act. The local people of South Africa, the African culture, they can get married in terms of the Recognition of Customary Marriages Act.
Yes.
Right? And all of these pieces of legislation, they were contested, right, by many during that time period. However, pieces of law was enacted. Now, the question that is then posed, why is government then not enacting legislation that recognizes Muslim marriages? So this is basically the type of arguments that are put forth. Why are we being sidelined? Why are we being discriminated against? Is there something wrong with Muslims in South Africa? And therefore, we are stating that if you have not done your work, the court must then hand down an order stating that government has not done as is required.
Just to take a step back, my understanding is that advocates for Muslim marriages have said that why can't government put the recognition of Muslim marriages under the Customary Marriages Act? Can you elaborate a bit further on that?
Yeah, obviously, if you look at it, the Recognition of Customary Marriages Act has certain consequences, right? As far as divorce is concerned, how it takes place, as far as the maintenance is concerned, as far as there are a number of aspects or provisions within that piece of legislation that has been custom made for recognition of customary marriages and per se. So when looking at Muslim marriages, it has other consequences in terms of Islamic law. And that is basically what is being requested by parties like United Ulama Council of Africa, that there should be legislation enacted that recognizes Islamic law, right, in terms of a piece of legislation known as, for example, the Muslim Marriages Act. So if there is a divorce, if there is a fight for custody, if there is a maintenance claim, if there is an application for divorce, it will be dealt with in terms of Islamic law. accepted Islamic law in an international scale.
Mm. Now, I understand that the Human Rights Commission also presented to the court, and there was a synergy between UCSA's presentation and theirs. And the presentation was significant because it spoke about government's role in the Muslim Marriage Bill. Now, from what the Women's Legal Center has told us on air, government has refused to pass the bill because it says that there's no consensus in the Muslim community with regards to how this bill should be enacted. You know, saying that the Muslim community must get their house in order. What would your position be on that, Sheikh?
If you were to ask that question, you can ask the same question with the Recognition of Customary Marriages Act. There was lots of controversy concerning that piece of legislation. There were many people who were opposing that piece of legislation. And the question is, why did government pass that piece of legislation?
Hmm.
And the same question could be asked a few years back when the Civil Union Bill was having its rounds, and they were from religious communities that were totally against the bill. There were people who made marches and so forth. But nonetheless, there was no consensus.
Mm.
So even though there was no consensus, the bill, but obviously there was also a court case, where the Constitutional Court gave the ultimatum to government, stating the following, that either you recognize these persons and you enact legislation that governs their marriages, or if you don't do that, automatically they will be recognized as and be entitled to get married in terms of the Marriage Act. Mm. So there was basically a court case that led to that. And this is something similar happening now with the Women's Legal Center case. Mm. But generally, to answer your question, there was no consensus in many of these bills.
Mm. Just speak to the Human Rights Commission's submission, though.
Basically, if you look at what UCSA has stated, it's looking at the position of females.
Mm.
All right. So if a female wanted to divorce her husband, for example, at times it is a bit difficult for her to go to these different institutions, personalities, and so forth. But if you look at the Muslim Marriages Bill, the current bill of 2010, it is basically more friendly upon women as far as application procedure is concerned, the grounds for divorce, the grounds for application for maintenance and custody and so forth. So it is basically giving the women in South Africa, or the Muslim women in South Africa, their due right as citizens of this country. And when this was put forward, by UCSA, the all other role players that are for human rights agreed with that.
Mm. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll try to unpack a little bit more on the Muslim Marriage Bill. Our two guests in studio, Sheikh Munir Abdurrauf and Sheikh Ihsan Talib. Stay tuned.
My radio station, your radio station, our radio station, 91.3 FM and 95.8 FM stereo.
24 minutes after 8, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome back to the show. It's MJ Speaks tonight until 9 o'clock. And we're trying to get to grips with the ulama's position, the United Ulama's position on the Muslim Marriage Bill. Of course, we saw a 10-year law reform process, and now the request to recognize Muslim marriages being heard at the Western Cape High Court, and recently the court hearing arguments from the state, the Women's Legal Center, and other interested parties on whether the failure to recognize Muslim marriages discriminates against women or not. Of course, we are taking your comments. 47913, that's the SMS line, and WhatsApp 0722380712. We want to hear from you on this very important topic. Sheikh Munir, if I can come back to you, there are many opposing parties on this case. I think there are about 20-something interested parties, one of them being the Association of Muslim Women of South Africa, and of course the United Ulama Council of South Africa, the other UCSA, known as the fake UCSA, if I can put it that way. They are saying that this bill is unconstitutional and that it goes against the Sharia. Why are they making those claims?
Yeah, if you look at that claim is unconstitutional. The bill is unconstitutional. What is being requested is to enforce your constitutional right to be treated equally by having laws enacted. The one question basically that one issue that could basically be problematic is basically putting it subject to the Constitution. Right? That is that's reality.
Yeah.
But the current status is that everything that we are subject to as Muslims in South Africa is also subject to the Constitution. Right. In the recent case that we referred to earlier on in the Western Cape High Court, there was a Sharia-compliant will drafted by the Muslim Judicial Council. Right. In the judgment, it states that. But nonetheless, when they interpret the will, and a few of the beneficiaries, they then renounced their rights. Then there was an interpretation issue of that very piece of legislation. But it was interpreted in terms of existing South African law. Again,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So what happened was that it was in terms of the Wills Act, and then again it was challenged on constitutional basis, right, stating that you recognize a person who is married, one of the surviving spouses or the widows was married in terms of the Marriage Act, but you do not recognize the widow who was married in terms of the Islamic law. Right, so they also, they're challenging the existing MGC certificate, right? Not necessarily the certificate, but the application or interpretation thereof subsequent to renunciation of rights. So saying that if the bill becomes an act, it will be challenged on constitutional grounds. Even if the bill does not become an act, we are already challenging many of our rights on constitutional basis. So the situation won't really change. But however, if the bill becomes an act, it will definitely make the current position, right? It will be better than the current position because it will be in Islamic law that is enacted, right? Not Islamic law that has been has come into effect as a result of changing existing South African law. And those are, my opinion is that all of those court cases that have gone to court, like the Daniels versus Edros, like the Hassam versus Jacobs, right, even the current, not the current case, that is where it coincided, where the Islamic law position and the South African law position is the same. But there are many cases where the decision handed down by the court was in terms of South African law principles and not necessarily in terms of Islamic law. In terms of the Muslim Marriages Bill, you will see that the orders would have been much, much more different.
Sheikh Hassan, you want to weigh in here. Why is there this perception, though, that the ulama from up north are very opposed to this bill? Is there a lack of consensus? Can we say there is a lack of consensus or differences of opinion on this matter?
Yeah, no, look, firstly, I think the just for some technicality, obviously this particular case that we are just in the light or in the wake thereof having this discussion, by the way, has no relevance in terms of the proceedings of the case to the Muslim Marriages Bill. It was obviously a case where government was being challenged in terms of not fulfilling its responsibility and obligation to pass legislation.
Yeah.
And government having obviously in the processes that have gone over the few years dragged its feet and now kind of almost like dug its heels into the ground and said they're not going forward. And so, obviously, from the United Ulama Council perspective, we are saying that no, that we are opposing that because, or rather, that we are supporting that motion, that motion that government should bring a legislative framework in place, because number one, the United Ulama Council of South Africa is representative of the vast majority of the ulama formations in our country. Of all the ulama formations in our country, the informal judiciary bodies across the country, there is one member among its constituency, namely the United Ulama, or rather the Jamiat, sorry, the Jamiat Ulama KwaZulu-Natal, who incidentally have also been amicus at the Cape High Court as a position that they wanted to take in opposition to the Muslim Marriages Bill, stating their case in that particular regard, alongside the Majlis, etc. But the vast majority of the ulama formations in our country are in support of this process. The reason being, as Sheikh Munir had indicated, is that this development and the accumulation of case law is happening in a very erratic way. It's happening in a chaotic manner, whereby the rest of us are based on our, obviously, as citizens in this country, if we should end up in front of the courts, then those judgments that have been handed down will serve as precedent, and we will all be bound by them. Mm. And as Sheikh Munir had indicated, those judgments obviously have been arrived at in light of South African pieces of legislation or pieces of South African legislation.
Yeah.
And whilst those women in those circumstances, they have managed to access some kind of redress, the awards were to a large degree in contravention of the Sharia.
Mm.
So that is already happening.
Mm.
All the time it's already happening.
So in other words, you're saying that this piecemeal approach is not sustainable. It's not working.
At all, because if we should have a viable framework of legislation that is going to ensure that the bulk of our laws will then be covered in accordance with the Sharia, that there would be possibly constitutional challenge to something is plausible. There's possibility for that. But the problem is that we're already sitting in a scenario where the laws of the Sharia are already being subjected to the laws of the country.
Mm.
So we are saying that had the judges had the benefit of a legal framework such as the Muslim Marriages Bill, which could then become a Muslim Marriages Act, they would have had a framework within which to actually hand down their judgments, as opposed to having solely to rely on pieces of South African legislation.
Sheikh, are you then, in essence, are you saying that the current system or the current processes within our Islamic judicial bodies are not actually effective? Are you conceding that there are problems in sort of regulating these kind of issues, you know, when it comes to divorce and inheritance and that sort of thing?
But precisely that is the very essence that we started out with, to say that these judicial, informal judiciaries have no legal authority. In our Sharia, we have this notion of, that Sayyidina Umar had referenced, the Sulta Tanfiliya. So it's the executive authority, which allows a ward that is being handed down by a judicial sort of organ or the judicial to become binding, and in the absence whereof there's very physical and very specific punitive kind of consequences to that.
Yeah. Let's speak a little bit more about this, you know, this piecemeal approach, as the Women's Legal Center put it, you know, saying that the Sharia, this argument that the Sharia is being violated because there's no regulatory framework in place, that the Sharia is being undermined. Perhaps your comments on that, Sheikh Munir?
Yes, definitely. If you look at the two cases I referred to early on, the Daniels versus Campbell, both to do with inheritance, and even the case of last week in the Western Cape High Court, or a few days back in the Western Cape High Court, all to do with succession law matters. Had there been pieces of legislation that govern the Islamic law of succession and administration of deceased estate in terms of Islamic law, there would have been no need for large sums of money to be spent or hours in court in order to enforce rights. And at the end of the day, when the judgments were handed down, it was in terms of existing South African law. For example, the Daniels versus Campbell.
Mm.
Right, the person passes away, leaves behind a surviving spouse. The surviving spouse has no recourse in terms of any South African law legislation, anything, right? Because he's not recognized as a surviving spouse in terms of the Intestate Succession Act or his spouse. So she challenges that and says, look, you're right, this piece of legislation is unconstitutional because you're not recognizing me as a spouse.
Mm.
Right. Thereafter, they say, yes, actually, it's right. We have to treat you all equal. It's unconstitutional. Equality provisions has been infringed. And therefore, we will read in. And now we will also include you to be one of the beneficiaries as a spouse, surviving spouse, in terms of the Intestate Succession Act. Right. Or survivor. So, in that instance, the relief was awarded. However, it wasn't awarded in terms of Surah An-Nisa, ayah number 11 or ayah number 12 more specifically, right? That says now if you pass away and you leave behind a surviving spouse, then she will inherit 1/8. If there are children, there are no children, she can inherit 1/4. It was in terms of the Intestate Succession Act of 1987. Right, so the mere fact that we are giving now, we have changed, we have violated the Sharia by now granting or taking of the rights of others. They say the Quran says the children should inherit so much, the parents should inherit so much. The Intestate Succession Act says, or provides, if there is a surviving spouse and the estate is worth less than 250,000 rand, there's nothing for the children. They have a claim for maintenance, yes, but not no inheritance. There's nothing for the parents. Even though if you read the Quran, and the Quran is very specific and says that there's punishment if you don't do this, we are violating the Sharia. That court judgment violated the Sharia. We are saying that the parliament must enact legislation that governs basically how, for example, the deceased estate might be distributed.
So it's a very tricky balance then.
In fact, Sheikh, if one considers again, just coming back to this whole idea of the framework, you know, when we in the process of public participation and submitting on the South African Law Commission's bill that it had first circulated, obviously from the ulama, United Ulama perspective, you know, we then found that there were certain sort of very unique Sharia kind of features which were absent from the bill. For example, in the Holy Quran, the notion of mediation, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that when there is a fear of a breakdown of the marital tie, then send a delegate from the family of the wife and send a delegate from the family of the husband so that they may go and actually mediate between the two parties. So this is something which we've inserted as contributions into the bill, which will allow a couple whose marriage is in trouble to then undergo what we are referring to from an Islamic law perspective as a almost compulsory mediation process, and that particular process, obviously, if given the due procedures to unfold and the mechanism to allow a resolution of the disputes, and then thereafter possibly as well, we were referencing the notion of voluntary arbitration that could also take place. The projection in and around that would be is that there'll be a small amount of cases that will eventually land up in the court. All these disputes will in fact be resolved in internal to our community structures. Obviously, it would mean that the informal judiciaries that are currently operating at certain sort of perhaps capacities, etc., would have to to capacitate themselves to levels that will also allow a certain measure of confidence from the side of the judiciary in terms of the processes and but those are all things that can be done, and those are all things that are in place also as we speak, but that's not to say there isn't a room for improvement. The point would be is that those mechanisms would then allow for the disputes between parties to be resolved within the community without, you know, a large part of these things eventually landing up in court. At the moment, in order for women really to, and it's obviously in the most of these cases, if not all, women trying to access their wealth, they have to go to court. And again, as we have said, these are highly expensive processes for people to eventually come and access their rights.
I see there are a few messages that have come through, rather questions, which I think we'll rather take at the end of the show, and hopefully our ulama or our shuyukh can answer some of those questions. For now, we're going to take an ad break, and when we come back, we'll sink our teeth even more into the Muslim marriage bill. Don't go away.
The Voice of the Cape, celebrating, bringing you 22 years of community broadcasting.
My radio station, your radio station, our radio station, the Voice of the Cape.
91.3 FM stereo.
8:42 and welcome back to the show. Of course, we're talking about the Muslim marriage bill and the fact that advocates for the bill are saying that it's moving too slowly and that women are being disadvantaged. I actually attended a workshop at the weekend and the attorneys there spoke of the conditions that many women find themselves in, you know, post-divorce or after death, women being kicked out of their homes and left with no access to property, to money and resources in their event of a divorce or death. So there was a lot of passion from the advocates speaking, or for the activists rather, speaking about the necessity of the urgency of this bill or this legal framework being passed. So please do SMS us 47913 and WhatsApp 0722380712 if you want to interact or comment on this particular issue. Perhaps we can go back to you, Sheikh Munir, in terms of just speaking a bit more about how, let's just speak about the UKSA and the MJC. Does it believe in, does it support the codification of Muslim personal law?
Yes, the question basically, the answer to the question is a definite yes. The Muslim Marriages Bill has been coming on for quite a time. And it's currently also spearheaded by the United Ulama Council of South Africa. The bill has gone through various drafts, right? It spoke about, as Sheikh Ihsan has mentioned, the compulsory mediation, the optional arbitration, and then adjudication thereof. And the provisions therein, it has been looked at in terms of constitutional challenges even, and then certain things were changed within the framework of existing Islamic law around that is internationally accepted, as followed in countries like Egypt and Syria, and opinions within like Madhahib of the Maliki Madhab and so forth. Right, so it has gone through a process by qualified ulama, and the mere fact that they have done that, and the United Ulama Council being an organization that represents the majority of the Muslims in South Africa, and they are supporting this bill, I would say then it could be then definitely be said that the Muslims in South Africa are supporting this piece of legislation and also wanting enactment of legislation in order for us to enforce our rights. Mm. Not only to have a right that is not enforceable, because a right without any remedy is basically not worth the paper that is written on.
Mm. Are you able to speak to international examples or models of success where this was successfully implemented?
Yeah, many, many Islamic countries like Egypt, they have laws that govern the Muslim personal law codes. Syria has laws that govern the Muslim personal law codes. Even if you look at Indonesia, they have Sharia courts. If you look at Singapore, they have Sharia courts. So it's something that is it's practiced around the world. Mm. Even in these countries where this constitutional challenge comes up, they are even at times signatories to something referred to as CEDAW, this international convention that speaks specifically about discrimination against women. And then these countries, they enact legislation, they have their rules and laws, and they said, look, you're right, that we also agree with that, subject to the Sharia. Right? So they say, look, you're right, that we basically signing this piece of legislation, but subject to it being compatible within the Sharia framework. So it is definitely happening within right around the world as far as a codification is concerned. Sheikh Ihsan, can you even elaborate more on that?
Yeah. It's actually quite telling that, across the Muslim world, obviously legislation has occurred. Mm. Codification of the Islamic law, specific to the context of that society, has occurred. And so it is important for us to understand that, there's sometimes these misnomers that are thrown around, yeah. Which are really actually fallacies. This one or that one wants to change the Quran. Hmm. The whole idea of thinking that anybody could change the Quran is really quite serious, and could actually amount to a certain amount of blasphemy, because Allah Ta'ala in the Holy Quran Himself guarantees that cannot happen. And so when one speaks of the the processes of Islamic law, you start with the sources, which is the Quran and the Sunnah. And that is what is strictly referred to as the Sharia. But then you talk to, obviously, the process of interpretation of that Sharia, which our founding jurists, like the four Madahib, for example, the founders of the four Madahib have done, and they formulated their schools of thought, which is a human endeavor of interpretation of the sacred texts.
Yeah.
So the sacred texts would not change, but the interpretations, as we know, may be varied
yes.
and different. But that's not where it stops either. So, you know, at the Al-Azhar University, for example, and in many of universities in the Muslim world, you'll find that they have, unlike in Saudi Arabia where Sheikh Munir and I had studied, you'll find that the faculties of law referred to themselves as the faculty of Sharia and Qanun, for example. Mm-hmm. Now, that is specifically, now, those two words, if they used in a phrase like that, obviously they mean two different things. So it's the faculty of Sharia and, on the other hand, legislation.
Yeah.
You understand? So the process of legislation is then still yet a third sphere of development of Islamic law, after interpretation.
Yes.
And that sphere of development is contextualized by the urf, the customs and the ada of a given locality.
Yes.
And that is what is known as your taqneen or your codification. And in a more general sense in our sharia, it fits into the genre of authorship and scholarship known as siyasa shari'iyya. Siyasa shari'iyya is about Sharia-oriented public policy. So that public policy, which is Sharia-oriented, is then the basis upon which your codification takes place, because it must take into very intimate consideration the context of the place in which that piece, yes, of codification is now going to be applied.
Mm.
And so, therefore, obviously, I mean, it's like, you know, axiomatic, it goes without saying, that Muslims who are living in a non-Muslim country, we have to abide by the laws of this country. Not do we just have to abide by the laws of this country. These laws affect us in every conceivable way.
Right.
And so the whole notion of the application of the rule of law is central in Islam. Because if you don't have the rule of law, you actually have lawlessness and you have anarchy.
Mm.
And we have very sensitive laws pertaining to the sacredness of living in spaces where the rule of law actually applies. And so I think for us also here, it is critical for, and the ulama and the scholars who understand this, for them it goes without saying that when you're talking about putting a piece of legislation and codification in place, there's no way that that means that you're changing the Quran, because the Quran cannot be changed, the Sharia cannot be changed. It is its practical application within a given context, which will then be dictated by what the urf and the customary practice and the psycho-social, political, economic climate of that particular location is all about, that will inform the final outcome of a codification process.
Shukran for that intense explanation. A comment here from 7250, just a rectification. It's not the court that misinterpreted Sharia inheritance law in the recent Mursak case. It was the executor of the will who opted not to follow Islamic law with regard to renunciation. Sheikh Munir, any comment on that?
Yeah, he's probably reading from the case verbatim. I've seen that. But I also made a comment early on that basically in terms of Islamic law and South African law, the outcome is the same. What happened here was that, as my understanding of the case, there was basically children of the deceased, and they've all basically renounced their right. In terms of Islamic law, there's something referred to as the kharuj, and they basically said that they are now gifting this, or giving it now to the surviving spouses in equal shares. So Islamically, it was okay. So the executor basically just very cleverly did that by making use of this piece of legislation. However, in other contexts, it might be more problematic. If in the event the children who decide then also then to renounce their rights, but they want actually someone else to inherit, that piece of legislation, that section of the Wills Act wouldn't allow for something like that. And therefore, there is a need actually to have pieces of legislation that is interpreted, and the consequences thereof would be in terms of Islamic law, but not as in terms of existing South African law principles, which are not at times, yes, it'd be the same outcome, but at other times it would not be, based on the given set of facts.
Well, we're going to have to break quickly for ads. It is 8:52, and when we come back, we'll look at the discuss the last few points of this particular show.
Live from Cape Town. This is the Voice of the Cape, 91.3 FM.
6 minutes to go before 9 o'clock, and time is definitely not on our side this evening. Trying to digest the Muslim Marriage Bill with my guest Sheikh Ihsan Talib as well as Sheikh Munir Abdurrauf. And a question has come through on the WhatsApp line. When there is deference, both parties can't go to the Imam or Islamic courts. How can some non-Muslims mediate on the Muslim personal law? Sheikh Munir, perhaps. Or Sheikh Ihsan?
Yeah, look, the issue of non-Muslim adjudication. Again, if one, for example, looks at the processes of the Muslim Marriages Bill, as the United Ulama Council of South Africa, what we've done was we've submitted provisions for one of two things, is that there should be a Muslim judge and or Muslim assessors, experts that will be guiding the judge. And so if there isn't a Muslim judge, then there will be assessors, experts, that will also be obviously be in the sort of support of the court in those kinds of particular cases. Mm. So that is a particular matter that obviously is still subject to the process of acceptance, and is it something that will pass? Is it something that will... So I think just from a relevance perspective, those are the kind of references in the Muslim Marriages Bill that I think the question refers to. Mm. The idea that we have a piece... Firstly, if we talk about mediation, if one obviously talks about what we have referenced in this discussion here, we are talking about the informal judiciaries having the recognition that the processes of mediation can be resorted to for women and couples to be able to come to some in line with the Quranic injunction, that a delegation from her side, delegation from his side come together and they try to resolve the matter. Mm. We believe that these are the kind of mechanisms that will bring about a solution for the bulk of cases, because also the disputes that most of the time the couples are basically saddled with are the disputes of facts, right? The disputes of etc. And so those kinds of things, through mediation, normally reasonable processes will bring solutions to that. Mm. And so that obviously is something that can be, in our context, we've said the informal judiciary should be empowered to be able to take that forward in line with this viable piece of legislation framework. That is on the one hand. On the other hand, if we had non-Muslim judges who are now and let's say that is now a scenario which is a matter that cannot be secured, and therefore there isn't always going to be availability, for example, of Muslim judges, and we have then said that if there's a non-Muslim judge, there should be Muslim assessors assisting the court in that particular regard. That judge will obviously then be governed by the piece of legislation that would hopefully have seen the light of day, that would hopefully have come into existence, and that if that piece of legislation is in existence, it will be the legislation which is governed by and guided by Islamic law that the judge will be basically functioning under. If we again compare that to where we are today, Muslim couples, Muslim marriages are being adjudicated upon by non-Muslim judges as it stands, but in lieu of and in light of pieces of legislation, which is obviously nothing to do with Islamic law.
Mm. Do you think that, you know, if the bill is passed, would it then give enforcement rights to the Sharia courts or the MJC, for example?
Well, there is probably a scenario like that, but that comes through process, obviously, of mediation and arbitration that would then have to be confirmed by the courts, right? Mm. And once it's confirmed by the courts, it will obviously have that executive sort of power.
Mm. We've got about 2 minutes left. I think I just want to end off perhaps speaking about how the MJC is going about educating its constituency, its members, with regards to this whole issue. Sheikh Munir, if you can perhaps comment on that.
Yeah, basically, when the MJC has come in, we firstly tried to empower or basically inform the ulama, the imams and the mashayikh that are members of the Muslim Judicial Council.
Mm.
Right, so that is basically one way. As well as the mere fact of looking at the United Ulama Council of South Africa, we are sitting here with the president of the United Ulama Council of South Africa, so there are many other bodies that fall under this. And each of these bodies are basically going out and trying to inform the community, more specifically the mashayikh and imams and maulanas. And then thereafter, when they go back to their communities, the masajid and so forth, they then impart this to their constituencies. Right. When the bill initially, right, there was various versions of the bill. When it came out, there was even a stage where the Muslim Judicial Council and the United Ulama Council went from mosque to mosque, going to the communities, asking for their input and so forth. And based on that, they had made their submissions. So there has been lots of public participation and information and education around this, but definitely there is a need to have more of this.
Sheikh Ihsan, maybe from your side, perhaps how the MJC is conscientizing or educating the broader public or mobilizing Muslims to understand this for a little bit better. I know that IPSA's made remarkable strides in that, in terms of the symposiums that they've held. Like I said, there are activists on the ground that are also doing there a little bit, having mentioned that workshop that I attended at the weekend. The MJC's role in terms of educating the broader public?
That is absolutely essential. I think, with the bit of, activity that has now arisen as a result of this particular court case as well, there has been a time when there was really a lull period. There was a stagnant period for a very long time. As Sheikh Munir had correctly, referred to, there was a lot of public community engagement processes previously.
Mm.
What has happened thereafter was that there has been some very extreme advocacy that against the bill in the form of takfir, in the form of declarations of kufr, of almost virtually every aspect of this particular process, which is very regrettable. Unfortunately, that is the kind of context as well as atmosphere that also gave kind of rise to that lull period and also obviously from government side there's been a lot of activism on the basis of this extreme rejectionist kind of approach where it declares literally the entire process is a process of disbelief and kufr. And so I think there is a renewed sense of the need of education, the need of taking this process forward.
Yeah.
There is still a very clear realization that it is really an tenable situation that we do not have a viable piece of legislation for Muslim marriages that will allow the courts of our country to adjudicate and award solutions in disputes that would be in conformity and compliance in the large part with Islamic law and the Sharia.
On that note, we're going to have to leave it there. It's been a very, very interesting discussion. I've certainly learned a lot over the past hour. Shukran so much to our guest Sheikh Ihsan Talib as well as Sheikh Munir Abdurra'o for their great insight on this particular topic. I'd really like to propose that we pick up this topic again perhaps next week or at a later stage if you are available again, because certainly it is a lot to go through and 1 hour is very limiting, and perhaps if we can perhaps have a debate at a later stage with the various role players in this particular case. Shukran so much to you, the listener, for tuning in this evening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.